What you are about to witness has never been performed in front of a podcast audience before. Audio prestidigitation, that is to say, sleight of hand, or, I guess, in this case, sleight of ear. Sorry. In this episode, I chat with composer Darren Hagen about his opera Orson Rehearsed, which is about Orson Welles, best known as the director of the movie Citizen Kane and the radio drama War of the Worlds. And I'm using the term opera loosely here because what Darren has actually created just kind of uses opera as a jumping off point. He's taken the form of opera and he's rearranged it into something new. What he has to teach us in this episode is both about a fascinating person that was Orson Welles and about the creative use of form in music that's been around for a very long time. This interview and Darren's creation are, in fact, magic tricks, and Darren does the thing that magicians are sworn never to do. He tells us all of the tricks of how he pulls off his new opera thingy. I, of course, will never tell the secrets of my trade. Whatever that is. Also, speaking of magic, it would be magical if you would head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to us and subscribe to, rate, and review the show. Tell your friends and family about us. Tell your enemies too. It'll make them better people. And now, a word from our sponsor. Maestro Classics was created in 2004 by Stephen Simon, conductor of the Washington Chamber Symphony and executive director Bonnie Simon. For years, their family programs introducing classical music to families played to sellout crowds at the Kennedy Center and were praised by the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. Maestro Classics was created to record and share these works for narrator and orchestra to the world. Recorded at the Abbey Road Studios, ooh, Beatles, with the London Phil, these recordings contain some of the finest children's music ever produced. True story. Learn more at Maestro Classics at maestroclassics.com, and you can save 17% on all CDs and MP3s with the code CLASSROOM. You know, like classical classroom. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement. Oh,
I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
music. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom.
Daisha, it's not like you know what you're doing or something.
I don't. That's the whole premise of my show, Darren.
Okay. All right. Listen, then let's stop talking and let's just do this, because I just enjoy your company so much that let's just do it.
Yeah. Let's stop talking and start talking, right?
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Okay. Here we go. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I am Daisha Clay, and here with me from the cat-friendly Radio Arts Foundation in New York is Darren Hagen. This is his third time on Classical Classroom. Darren is a composer, conductor, librettist, so many other things. He's been commissioned by symphonies and operas all over the place, including the Symphony and Opera here in Seattle. And he's been celebrated by people that you may have heard of, like Joanne Folletta and Leonard Bernstein, for God's sakes. Darren's been on the classroom before to talk about the work of other composers, but today we're going to talk about his own work, a new work called Orson Rehearsed, which is, and I'm just going to quote his website to describe this, a broadly elastic multimedia musico-dramatic prestidigitation.
And also, you can brush your teeth with it.
I hope he'll teach me something about the need or lack thereof for form in an opera and other kinds of music like that today. Darren, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice again, Daisha.
Aw, you. So let's jump into it. I want to talk first, because the thing about this work, and I don't even know what to call it, but we're going to get to that later. Let's talk about the story first. Did you write the libretto, I guess we're calling it, for this?
Yes. I suppose one would begin with a scenario, and then from a scenario you go to a treatment, from a treatment to a libretto. And I've co-written a number of librettos. This is my 12th opera. That's very scary and sounds like I'm very old. But what it really means is that I've this is a circus that I've visited before, and I've gotten to the point where I really wanted to do some in-depth exploration of a moment. So what I did was I took the last hour of Orson Welles' life, and I had the audience brought into his brain as he was experiencing the heart attack that claimed him ultimately. Mm-hmm. Now, everyone knows who Orson Welles was, I hope, but interestingly enough.
Oh, yeah, we should clarify that. He was a director.
Oh, ever so much more. He was a director, he was a producer, he was an actor, he was a visual artist, he was a writer, he was also a politician. He wrote speeches for FDR, he would coach FDR in public speaking, of all things, and briefly considered a run for Senate against McCarthy.
Wow.
Yeah. He would have been a great candidate, obviously, but he would have probably been a terrible senator because not a lot of interest in the actual governing, but a lot of interest in the communication. He was a complete polymath, and he was someone who didn't fit into the traditional production scenario of Hollywood. He was an auteur. It's not that he liked to do things on his own or that he didn't appreciate being told what to do. It's that he was so good at so many different things that it was hard to contain him.
Wow.
Well, you know, and of course he made Citizen Kane. And he was the voice of the War of the Worlds, that the great here we are around Halloween, if I can specify when we're recording this, one of the all-time great Halloween pranks was his broadcast of the War of the Worlds. And he also was the director of The Cradle Will Rock, Mark Blitzstein's great labor opera during the 20s, that to this day constitutes perhaps the greatest moment in live American music theater history.
Wow.
Yeah,
how did Orson Welles kind of come into your life? Like, why is he an important figure for you?
Well, when I was in fifth grade in Wisconsin, Mr. Cummings, my teacher, had the LPs of the original War of the Worlds broadcast and played them of a Halloween at school. And I was so taken with it that a few weeks later, I recreated the entire broadcast with my buddies over the school's public address system.
What? And that's awesome.
Ever since then, I've been a huge Orson Welles fan.
Nice.
And he was a Wisconsin boy like me. So what's not to love?
Why focus on the last hour of his life? You sort of touched on the fact that you wanted to really focus in on a moment as an artistic exercise, I'm guessing. But like, why that moment?
Well, you know, there's that old cliche of a person's life rushes before their eyes, you know, in their final moments. It's a perfect setup for an examination of someone's life, but it's also a great opportunity to fracture the usual storytelling methods. You know, you can create a nonlinear narrative that is in fact like DNA. I split up Orson into three Orson Welles: a young, middle-aged, and dying Orson. So he saw himself simultaneously. He would sing trios with himself. And ultimately, in later manifestations of this piece, there'll be Marlene Dietrich will be in it, and Rita Hayworth, his wife, and Oya Kodar, his final partner. They'll be singing with him as well. So he's time, space, memory, imagination all become part of the mix, so that at any given time in a piece like this, you've got the equivalent of a page or two of Joyce's Ulysses, let's say. Who can capture an entire mind, but you can capture some of the great synapses in a genius's mind. And of course, he was a genius.
Give me a sprint, so not that one is enough. some part of me. I don't know which contradicts the rest. Let's good line tell job. Edit, as though he's directing. Edit, in the script. The other one is Chief West. Rip in the other. I'll be the cast and I will tear the hell out of him. Edit. Let's add something there. In the early years of the 20th.
So, everything about this is malleable. Everything about it, the way that you've set it up, is changeable. And it, you know, it says here on the website that it takes a different shape every time that it's performed, that, you know, it may be staged or unstaged. It may, in fact, not exist at all, except as a set of options. This is madness to me.
Yes, isn't that great?
I mean, isn't art meant to give like form and meaning to life, which is an otherwise sort of arbitrary bunch of information and action? And if art isn't accommodating life, don't we just have madness, anarchy?
But here's where we come into the slate of hand. If you have a 70-minute piece, and every 3 to 5 minutes consists of a pre-composed chunk of of electroacoustic and live players, and the beginning and the end are pre-composed, and they're probably 5 minutes each, you already have probably 15 minutes of music pre-selected. And if you want to spend time with each major character, you want to give each one an aria of their own. So at some point in the evening, each guy gets 5 minutes. So there's 15 minutes right there. So if this piece lasts an hour, half an hour of it is already predetermined.
I see.
The other half an hour that is going to be chosen on the fly by whoever the director is of that production. And the parts will arrive on the iPads of the orchestra players, and on a screen backstage, the players will know about 30 seconds before the next scene begins which scene is going to happen next. So the person who is the magician for that performance sits out in the audience with a little app on his phone, reads and feels how the audience is reacting to what they're seeing, and chooses the next scene accordingly.
Oh, wow.
So there is, in fact, a great deal of order, but there is the illusion of anarchy. And it is in that creation of illusion that suspension of disbelief is encouraged, because you are encouraged to go with the flow.
So, you know, we have to talk for a second, Darren.
Okay.
You can't do this thing that you've done. You've made. You're messing with form here, man.
It's true.
This is unacceptable.
That is the thing to do, and it's the ultimate. I'm such a bad boy. No, it's in theater, I've always loved the fact that, particularly in lyric theater, what you're doing is you're trying to go for the nuclear reactor of human experience, which is the moment of truth, the moment of greatest emotion, the, you know, what the Greeks called epiphany, right? And so if you're going to do that, and you want to get rid of all the recitatives, which are the dull parts, right? And you want to get rid of all the changes.
You have to say that word again.
Recitative. Oh, that's right. It's classical classroom. Sorry. Ding, ding, ding.
You got to teach us, man.
Well, remember, the recitative is reciting. It's the boring bits in traditional opera. And some composers and some opera lovers would insist that most operas today consist primarily of recitative, which is a kind of a sing-songy, getting rid of text sort of, you know, brum, I have to go to take out the garbage now, brum, but it already smells bad, brum, brum, take it out behind the garage, okay, dun, 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 and then there comes an aria about taking out the garbage, right? You're contrasting emotions about that. That is the traditional role of recitative, is to get there. So anyways, how do you get rid of that entirely and focus on the good bits? And that's sort of what Orson Rehearsed does. It gets straight to the important moments. And it's not just an exploration, obviously, of wells. What it takes is it welds wells with my experiences so that I can express myself through wells as an avatar. Then for me, I've got myself, as Orson Welles would say, the world's best train set or the world's biggest playpen, an opportunity really to focus on rehearsing with the actors, playing the clarinet that is in the room to discover and to create a work of art that will never go the same way twice.
So just to make sure I've wrapped my head around this accurately, you have basically taken out all of the plot development, the story development, and you've gone straight for the action scenes.
Right.
And that is what we're witnessing here. So, you know, there's no exposition going on. It's all in your face action. And
yes.
And is that right?
And the thing that twists your noodle is, of course, since it's taking place in his mind, the action is all emotional and psychological.
Yeah.
So there are no sword fights, but there are emotional and psychological sword fights. And we all know inherently there is no drama in the fact that we know it's the last hour of his life, he's going to die. So we know that we're heading inevitably toward his demise. Since that bit of traditional narrative drama is taken from us, the audience then sort of sits back and says, well, you know, which way is this magic trick going to go? Mm-hmm. That's why it's called prestidigitation. Wells thought of himself as a magician. And he was, in fact, a member of the Guild of Magicians. And he loved...
No way.
Yes, he loved doing magic tricks. And much of what the revelation of truth is in magic, in theater, is done through sleight of hand, right? We can't actually stage a murder on stage, but what we can do is we can create the context through sleight of hand, through the magic of theater.
Wait, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, you know, murdering somebody on stage is not dramatic. One of the things that Orson Welles knew the best was, and we see that in something like War of the Worlds, is if there's a murder off stage, the audience's imagination is going to make it twice as horrible as it would be if they could see it. That's suspense, right? And that's what Hitchcock was a master of.
Interesting. Like, I was just thinking as you were explaining the mechanics of how this sort of prestidigitation happens, where everybody, it seems to be arbitrary, it seems to be happening just improvisationally, but in fact has guidance, like how you're pulling that trick off.
Absolutely. And all magic tricks are really, really carefully rehearsed. And you've spoken now to so many composers and performers, you know, in order to make it look like play, there are thousands of hours of practice behind that to make it look spontaneous.
Yeah, to make it look spontaneous.
Right.
That is really something. It seems to me, though, like that part of, and correct me if I'm wrong, like part of the way that you're carrying off this magic trick is that you're putting the moment before someone dies, the moment before this very important and very intense someone dies, and the sort of nature of that kind of moment, which is really intense and really, you know, life flashing before your eyes, all of that kind of stuff, that you're kind of putting that in the seat of importance as your sort of, that is the focus rather than all of the other stuff that goes into making an opera what it is. Everything else is sort of in service.
In service. That's great. That's a terrific observation. Okay. I think you nailed it. The setup, you just described the setup, and the execution is what I just talked about. But when you think about it, the way that one can justify this is that the interrelations between all of the pieces are so intense and so close that they hook up with each other and define through context one another. Just as I hate to say that Joyce sort of is the model here. If you've ever read Ulysses, you can read the whole thing and you get an idea. But then who really, unless they're really a devotee of Joyce, reads more than three or four pages of Ulysses at a crack for the rest of their life? But any two or three pages of Ulysses is a freestanding artwork in and of itself and an aesthetic experience. So the sense that one makes of this piece is you've got all the raw material you need at any given time to draw some conclusions. But the most important thing is that it lands emotionally. Nobody needs to know anything about Orson Welles, but you learn a lot about him. The emotions that he feels are universal, you know? Sorry, that was the alarm on my phone that rings that tells me that I have to take my kids off the bus. I'm very sorry.
Your kids are going to be really sad that you're not there right now.
Yeah, they're going to have to live lives on the street and get jobs.
They're going to be little street urchins.
Exactly, because their father was on the radio.
Because you had to be on Classical Classroom.
This is what I did for you, Dacia.
You're a giver.
That's me. I'm just a giver. Anyway, it all gets a bit heady. And I think that that's a beautiful thing that alarm went off, because that grounds us. Because we do think about the day-to-day, the quotidian, and getting the kids off the bus and making the mortgage payment and all of these other things. But at the last moment, what do you think about? You think about the things that you have regrets about, the people you loved, the universals. Mm-hmm. And so when you boil something down without linking material to the universals, you don't have to know anything about that person to feel it with them. And that's what opera tries to do. So what I'm really trying to do is distill 35 years of writing operas to that which I've learned turns me on the most about an opera, those moments.
The sort of emotionally heightened moments where you as a person actually connect with the music and with the art. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Check out the new Classical Classroom website at classicalclassroomshow.com to see an example of the website work our friends at New Y can do for you. In fact, did you know that you can now leave us an actual tip on our website if you are so moved? They can also help you with promotion to make sure the world knows about your shiny new website and your business. For more info, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. Okay, now back to my chat with Darren Hagen.
Peter's face is not on the bomb by her own choosing. Is this the face? Is this the face? But by election of the flyers who drop the bomb, Peter's face is not on the bomb by her own choosing.
I wonder, I listened to some of this that you sent me, and I was wondering about the actual instrumentation in this and kind of how you arrived at it, what you're doing with the music in this piece in general, because I heard everything from chimes and maracas and vibes to samples of Orson Welles' voice. So tell me what you were doing there and why those particular things.
Well, it wasn't actually Orson Welles' voice, or maybe 14 or 12 okay. seconds of Orson Welles' voice, because I don't want to get in trouble. But I sampled myself a fair amount and altered my voice, and that's part of the prestidigitation, the magic trick nature of this. The score for this first iteration that we did in Chicago consisted 50% of electroacoustic pre-recorded things.
Electroacoustic meaning that you're using like a combination of like instruments that might be more associated with rock music, like guitars and things like that, and more typical like a symphony orchestra variety instruments.
Ah, yes, I'm so glad you said that. No, actually, they might be included, but the electroacoustic element is just as in film nowadays. It consists of not just musique concrète, which are found sounds from our daily lives, like footsteps okay. and rain and things like that, but also samples of 5 to 15 second stretches of my long symphonic catalog and chamber music catalog that I own, stretching back 40 years, manipulated in the studio. Also, a limited use of the prepackaged loops that you can license cheaply online, MIDI, all sorts of different things, and also a few, I would have a performer come in and play me a few licks just to have a frisson of living person. And that track, it is only 50% of what you hear in concert or in performance. The other 50% is whichever living musicians participate in that performance. And in this first case, it was the Fifth House Ensemble, 11 live instruments that created a chamber orchestra of living human beings that intermeshed with the pre-recorded sounds and were mixed so that the audience never could differentiate who was real and who was pre-recorded.
Oh, interesting.
And this is, but you see, the lovely thing about this is when we go to the movies, we hear that all the time. When I first started writing opera and things like that, the idea was, oh, it must be strictly acoustic, or it's not going to, you know, be pure or something like that. I'm not quite sure what the justification was. But I've been sneaking pre-records, not to flesh out and make small orchestras sound big, but just to avail myself of, you know, the ululations of other cultures and all sorts of extended vocalisms without having to put 40 people in the pit. I've been sneaking them into my shows for 20 years. And if it's done well, no one can tell and no one bothers. And audiences are just so accustomed now to hearing it that there's nothing particularly innovative about what I'm doing. All I'm doing is using tools that the commercial fellas have been using for a long, long time. That then, those two elements are combined with live singers. And the instrumentalists are also asked to sing periodically, because why not?
Sure, why not?
Having mental stability. Mental stability.
I suppose if there is an aesthetic stance, the styles of the music are all over the map too. I mean, it's Welles had a magnificent sense of the breadth of world music, of the different kinds of music. For instance, if Bernard Herrmann hadn't come out to Hollywood as Welles' sort of chosen composer, Herrmann would have had a great career on the East Coast as a concert music composer. Likewise, Welles loved all sorts of different kinds of music and have an acute sensitivity. He would remix all of the sounds on his soundtracks and often would revoice other characters in his movies when he didn't like the actual performance of the actor who did the role.
Wow.
He would dub their performance for them.
Oh my gosh. So, did he ever do that with women?
what an excellent question.
Just out of curiosity. I'm just imagining his deep voice, you know, like,
"Hello, this is Orson Welles as Desdemona." Who knows? You'd have to.
Yeah.
I'm by no means an Orson Welles aficionado. I'm a fan because he was so darn smart, and so creative, and lived such a large life.
Yeah, it seems like he was a very engaged, interested person.
That's the perfect comment. Yeah, I mean we should remain engaged and not fearsome. I don't think that he was ever afraid. You know, the night that he died, he had just appeared that afternoon on the Merv Griffin show, mm-hmm. and had spoken with great love of Rita Hayworth, mm-hmm. and of Garbo, and then he went out to dinner with friends at Ma Maison, his favorite restaurant, and had a wonderful conversation over a meal. And then he came home and he worked on shooting script for something that was going to take place the next day. Up until the very last moment, he may have felt like a bit of a shipwreck, but as he said to Mr. Todd, his great mentor, in a long phone call they had purportedly had the evening that he died, for a shipwreck, he was too busy to sink. So up until his last moments, he was working.
Had he been sick leading up to that moment? And also, how old was he when he died?
Oh, boy. I think I'll have to check Wikipedia for that. He died on October 10th, 1985, and he was born in 1915, so he lived to be 70.
Oh. Okay.
And it pains me, and it's so much an artifact of our culture that when you type Orson Welles into Google, oftentimes the first thing that comes up is that horrible Paul Masson ad that he did because he was drunk during a shooting of a commercial.
And it's no way.
Oh, it's terrible. I think you can write in drunk Orson and it comes right up. And for a man who had accomplished so much to be brought so low, to be raising money for his films, mm-hmm. is really quite Shakespearean. And for a man who, as a very young man, did a concordance of how to bring Shakespeare, everybody's Shakespeare, it's called, to young people, who was clearly a genius, it's been very, very difficult for him to watch the rise of George Lucas and the rest of his generation, and to know that he had started at the top. To make Citizen Kane, which is still understood to be one of the two or three greatest films ever made, at the beginning of your career, think how hard it is to start at the top and work your way down for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that is why he had like the opposite problem of most artists. He came out of the gate great, and then I'm guessing spent the rest of his life having to live up to that moment of greatness.
That's a good point. What time does is telescopes in reverse. He had a good 25 or 30 years when he was at the top of his game and arguably remained at the top of his game. It's that the world did not give him the opportunities, and he eschewed many of the opportunities that would have allowed him to continue to be in the public eye at the top of his game. Also, here's a critical thing. The reason I call it Orson Rehearsed is because of his great gloss on Moby Dick, Moby Dick Rehearsed.
Moby Dick Rehearsed?
What? Yeah. His idea to stage Moby Dick, but very early on in rehearsals, he realized that he enjoyed rehearsing it more than performing it. So what he did is, this was in London, he created an omnibus sort of a sandbox piece called Moby Dick Rehearsed, where every time it was performed, it was different. You see, now here's where I got my idea. And sometimes he would gauge what was going on in the audience, and he'd shove one of his team out there, he said, do the Pequod scene where this happens now. And then if things were just going cold in the audience, he might come out and do a monologue or talk about being Orson Welles. It was the Orson Welles variety show through the lens of Moby Dick. This was back in London in the 60s, I think. And he was already there. I posit that, in fact, having started at the top, even by the time he got to the second, third, and fourth films, like Amberson's and It's All True, and the films that he just started leaving in hotel rooms half cut or cut. I think that he enjoyed rehearsing them and shooting them and going through the process of making film and theater far more than he enjoyed the process of having to sit there in a movie theater having critics judge him. I think that he decided, quite rightfully, as many artists do, that it was much more fun making art than having to endure the results of having made art.
Do you think that that was born out of when you are creating a piece of art, you're recording a piece of music, you're making a painting, whatever, there is a point at which you have to call it. Even though you know that future you is going to maybe not be completely satisfied with the work that you've done, or may just hate it because past you was stupid or whatever, you know, if you're a self-critical person. Do you think that there was some of that in Welles, that he, you know, because when you do that, when you release something out into the world, you're releasing it out there for the public to judge, for your future self to judge.
I think that that is, again, I hate to compliment you because why should I say anything nice about anybody? But it's a great question. And here's the irony. Maybe this is why we're talking today. Here's my stance on this question. In Seattle, I wrote an opera for that company called Amelia. The end of the opera consists of a woman giving birth to a daughter named Amelia. She is surrounded by hospital technicians and her doctor and so forth. But during the course of the opera, it has been revealed that these are the actors who also portrayed her missing father and her husband and her best friend and other people. And it emerges that at the moment of giving birth to this child, she becomes open to the possibilities of being truly alive. Now, for me, this was a great epiphany. I had felt that after 10 operas, I'd finally really gotten it right. I had shared my truth, capital T. Now, this sounds very pretentious and very portentous and very heavy. And it was all of these things. And it was a number of years ago, so I had a little boy who my first son was only about a year old. So I was coming to terms with all of these things. I had always, since the death of my mother many, many years before, felt surrounded by my ghosts. And this woman, Amelia, in this opera was surrounded by her ghosts, who all came back and were, in fact, waked at the end of this opera. And I realized, wow, there it is. I finally did it. And my wife and I left McCall Hall, and it was raining, of course. And I said, I did it. That's it. I nailed it. And I didn't say it to my wife because I knew not to tempt the wrath of the thing atop the thing. But I felt like, wow, now the audience really, it's going to reward me. The critics are going to say I'm a genius. It's going to be great. And you know what? It was good. It was a success. It was every bit of a success that the company wanted, and the commissioner was very happy. And I was personally deeply fulfilled by the journey that I had taken as a creator with my colleagues and my collaborators. Mm-hmm. Okay, so about a month later, I realized, oh, wow, I was the only one who really, really felt that way. Maybe a handful of other people may have, but my epiphany was to the other people in the theater, a good night in the theater, and maybe even an excellent night in the theater, but all it was a night in the theater. And for me, this was, I know that this sounds ridiculous, but for me, this had the power of a revelation. I had been for 25 or 30 years working toward the moment when I would really get it right. And once I got it right, I realized that getting it right wasn't the point. that it was the process of getting it right. I almost stopped composing after Amelia. And it took me a long time to realize, oh, this is when I started directing. Oh, it's the process of staging Amelia that was the good part. It was the process of the performance. It was the process of getting up to the birth of a new work. And Wells always, he did release the films that he could. But I think that my feeling about a premiere now of an opera is that I don't want to curse it, and I don't want to sound as though I'm in any way prideful or hubristic, but I don't really care about the critical reaction anymore, because I've already taken all of the deep fulfillment I need as a creative person from the process of making the work with other people and bringing it to life and going through the process of doing it. And I like to think that Orson Welles felt the same way. At least that's what I'm projecting onto Welles in this piece. That the process was more important than the double bar at the end. So he wasn't. I don't think he was fearful at all. I don't think he was afraid of anything. I think he knew quite well that his position in history was secure, if he cared about that at all. And one thing that Orson Welles did say, which I take to heart, is that what difference does your name make in the end? You know, our works. He said something to the effect that our works last a millennial or two. But even then, they're washed away by history. And very few things last. So what is important? The now. To be here now. To create the art, go through the process, which is a profound secular humanist expression. And ultimately one of faith, that people are up to the challenge. But whether it will be remembered, what does he care? What did he care in the end, I think?
Which brings us full circle to the fact that you've created this new work that's really all about the process. You're having your cake and eating it too here. You're getting this live show that's all about making a live show.
Yeah. It took us a while to get there, but I guess now we've created the context where my motivation makes probably more sense.
Yeah.
And one hopes that the audience goes for the ride. And the true trial run was when the audience test drove it in Chicago and people were genuinely moved.
Yeah. Darren Hagen, you have blown my mind once again.
Oh, good.
I feel like this interview itself has been prestidigitation. Was it an interview? We made people think that it was.
Well, we came full circle just as we had hoped we would, and I think that is a testament to your prowess as an interviewer.
We didn't even discuss it beforehand, that it would happen like that.
Well, we can reveal that for 30 seconds we started talking about something, but then we said, hey, we got to stop talking so we can start talking.
Start talking.
Take care, my friend.
Darren, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being back on the show again. Anytime you've got something new, give me a holler. Okay, everybody, that does it for this episode. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. By the way, our website has some pretty sweet new features. You can download free lesson plans and study guides for many of our episodes. You can leave us a message. And if you're feeling so moved, if you want to support the work that we do at Classical Classroom, you can now do so financially. Just click the little button that says Tip Jar. As always, you can also email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM in Seattle, where we feel comfortable enough to walk around in our sweatpants. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official hat supplier of Classical Classroom, Harry's Haberdashery, where they heart hatless heads. Thanks to Darren Hagen for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time. Abracadabra! Razzle dazzle, jazz hands.